Welcome to Smith Weekly Discussions, an occasional program for our members of Smith Weekly Research. Please note this program is a private discussion and everything contained herein is for entertainment and educational purposes only. With that, we hope you're in a comfortable position, along with your favorite beverage, to enjoy the discussion. We remind our audience to examine our show notes attached to each of our shows to better understand how our program functions. Before we get into our discussion, we want to say thanks for questions coming from our audience at Smith Weekly, including Chris C., Paul M., Todd A., and Sean M. On the program today is a returning guest. Mr. David Cates is back with us. David is the president and CEO of Denison Mines. The company is focused on developing its Phoenix uranium project using the in-situ recovery process. Denison Mines also has a number of other various stage uranium projects on the east side of Athabasca Basin, as well as partner interest in Orano's McClean Lake Mill facility. Denison Mines is listed on the New York Stock Exchange under the symbol DNN, as well as on the Toronto Stock Exchange under the symbol DML. David, it's a pleasure to have you back on the program. Welcome.
Well, thanks very much, and I'm very glad to be back on.
Yeah, David, it's been a while. We were just looking at the calendar and couldn't believe that it's been a number of years now since we've had you back on for an update. And of course, so much has progressed in this market, and of course, with Denison specifically over those years. So we have a bit to talk about, so hopefully the members are in for a little bit of a longer discussion today. But why don't we kick it off here with you giving us your take on the current state of affairs in the uranium market. You know, you're a CEO that actually, in our experience, well understands this market compared to many other CEO peers who maybe lack in that area. But you're certainly one of those that is very engaged with this market and have been here for quite a while. What are your thoughts on the current state of affairs in the uranium market?
Yeah, thanks for that, Andrew. You know, maybe just for background, for folks that might be a little bit newer to the sector, I have found it's helpful to remind people that, you know, one of the responsibilities I had at Denison several years ago was to run Uranium Participation Corp, which became the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. So before Sprott took over management of that, it was a publicly listed company, Uranium Participation Corp, and Denison had a management contract on it. So we acted as management for that company. And so you're right in that there are few players in the sector that have actually participated in the uranium spot market to the extent that I have from my time managing UPC, but as well as Denison's own physical uranium purchases. So we do have a bit of a unique perspective on the market right now, particularly in the spot space, but also a sort of a look through to the term market. And it's, you know, what we're seeing fundamentally is a market that is reflecting scarcity. We have seen, you know, if we take a multi-year view on this, we've seen a market that was oversupplied for many years post-Fukushima. With production from producers that had protection from long-term contracts and were essentially overproducing, cheap interest rates, which allowed for traders to acquire those surplus pounds and basically carry them forward and make them available in subsequent years, which essentially was an inventory-driven environment. Now, on the back of that transaction between UPC and Sprott, the physical trust with Sprott got much more active in the space. And at the same time, we saw production curtailments from our majors, you know, Cameco and Kazatomprom, which was excellent. And so we've gone through several years now. You know, MacArthur was shut down in 2017, or at least the announcement in 2017. Several years where we've been in a fundamental primary supply deficit, meaning that the market is only balanced by drawing down excess materials. And the physical trust had a lot to do with that, but also that production curtailment, really significant part of that. What we've transitioned into now is a place where the cost of production matters rather than sort of the availability of balance sheets to carry extra material at rates and make it available and trade on it. That's sort of where we were before. Now the cost of production matters. And look, the first indication that we made that transition was the restart of MacArthur River. Now it restarted, why? Because Cameco was out signing a series of long-term contracts at prices that they believed would be sufficient to support their project over the long run. And they were pretty vocal about where they needed to be on that. They needed to be in the $40 to $50 per pound range environment. It's not that they locked in necessarily at $40 or $50, but that's the environment that they needed to see to sign contracts that would support their operation. And they did. And they were able to successfully build a book that would allow for a large mine to get restarted. But that's part of why we saw the price plateau in that range, because they were making material available. And so while they wouldn't make it available at a lower price, the sort of scarcity of that material was reduced when it was available at that price point. And so we did see a bit of a plateau at that price level. Now, as many of us now can tell from Cameco's disclosures, they've basically sold out production for the next several years. And is it now coincidence that the price has moved up subsequently? Well, I don't think it is at all. It again goes to scarcity. So now that the pounds are not being made available, the market has to go find the pounds. And I know I'm blurring the term market with the spot market in these kind of remarks, but that's because there is a level of blurring there. If you are making material available on a long-term basis today for the next several years, it impacts the interest a party would have in procuring in the spot market today. Similarly, if you are not making material available in the term market for the next several years, it increases the level of interest one might have to buy what is available today. And so we've now transitioned to a next leg of this uranium market journey where Cameco has pulled back from making material available and others. I mean, it's not simply Cameco, but Cameco is a major player in this. And we've seen that there is continues to be what those pounds away, there continues to be a scarcity. Pounds are not falling out of the tree. Pounds are hard to come by. It's incredibly difficult to create new sources of supply. And the spot market is reflecting that a degree of that scarcity. People who have extra material, and you could look at Denison with our physical uranium position, are not making it available in bulk at prices that were at $65. And so the price has moved up. Now, I think this is very positive. Scarcity is a fundamental factor to markets that drives price. We know that our utility customers do not have the ability to substitute. And we also know that supply is not easy to bring to market, not new supply. And so being in a scarce market with a limited ability to respond on supply, but with required demand, does create a situation where you normally would see prices rise. We have seen prices move up rapidly this year, but we are now seeing some healthy sort of market corrections and checkdowns, which everyone has to be prepared for. And so our prices moved up at as high as $107 in the spot market, has checked back down now into the low 90s. And I'm perfectly comfortable with all of that. That is how this kind of market or any market should function. What we are also seeing that gives us confidence, though, around this is that the long-term price is increasing. And so the long-term price is now up in the mid-70 range. And for those that are maybe less familiar with it, like the long-term price is, it is a different kind of measure. It's a base price indicator. Price of delivery on something that's quoted as, say, a $75 base price today. If the delivery is in 3 years and there's an inflation adjuster on that, the price at delivery is going to look more like $83, $85, something like that. So it's just a reference point, and people shouldn't get too carried away with the fact that it's 75 when the spot's 93. I mean, there are market factors for that, but the fact that spot is moving up supports the fact that higher prices are needed. And look, overall, Andrew, you get the sense that we're quite positive on this. And it's really because the cost of uranium for most development assets that will be needed in the long run is going up. Inflation has driven costs of production up. The jurisdictions that many of these projects in require high rates of return to manage risk. And the ability for supply to respond is overall poor. So those are strong fundamental characteristics to support higher prices.
Good lesson for everybody who needs to get a better grip on where we are here. And This correction is nothing new to us seasoned veterans that have been in this sector and lived and breathed this sector for the last 10 years, plus or minus a little bit there. And then the understanding there too, as well, I think people tend to lack. And the prevailing thought too, that extra supply could somehow just come online at the flip of a switch. Purely that's been demonstrated that that can't happen. And then also just how such a small amount of volume in the spot market can get people scared to the downside. And after having such a nice little move that we saw last year appreciate in the sector, especially in the spot market there. And then just the overall misunderstanding of term market and the fact that the term market lags in so many different ways, David, and is so oddly reported in so many different ways, of which we could talk about probably on a separate podcast and make one in itself. But one of the ones that caught me off the front of your conversation, physical uranium accumulation model, because you know this area very well, as you mentioned, with Uranium Participation Corp now, Sprott. Some folks out there are saying that the physical accumulation in these vehicles, with the discounts, reference Yellowcake, reference for the Sprott vehicle, some folks are saying that the physical accumulation vehicle is essentially dead. And of course, well, I'll save my comments on how we've approached this and how we've looked at this over the years. We've written about it many times. But what is your thought on the idea that, the physical accumulation vehicles are essentially dead at this point for investors?
Well, I mean, I think that's a dramatic way to describe how those vehicles have evolved. Sprott achieved some really important steps quickly on the transition from UPC to the Sprott Trust, and that was scale and liquidity. That's not gone away. The scale and liquidity remains, and that has made the product overall far more investable to a much broader group of investors. And so it continues to offer a good degree of leverage and tracking to the uranium price. And that's fundamentally what UPC was there for, and what Sprott still offers. The expectation that it would carry on with the degree of accumulation and growth, that it would carry on with that at a similar rate to its initial years, I think is unrealistic. It needed to achieve scale so it could offer the scale and liquidity to investors. It's done that. Accumulating more, our market doesn't need that anymore in terms of a sort of a curing of the oversupply situation. We have cured that. We are now focused on production costs. So it's served many purposes and continues to be relevant as a means to track the physical uranium, because there's no other way for an investor to be exposed without the mining risks to the physical material. So I absolutely don't think they're dead. I think the rate of growth is reasonably slowing because the scale has been achieved. But I think they're still quite relevant investment vehicles. And yeah, I'm really familiar with the discount to NAV challenge, because we had the same situation with UPC. But these things resolve themselves over time. It's always been that way. And whether they're leading or lagging indicators, it depends. Sometimes we found that it was leading, sometimes we found it was lagging. And so I don't think there's a universal truth to how people should look at that discount. What is universal is that it continues to offer a really reasonable way to track the physical price for uranium without the mining risk, and that'll continue to be a relevant investment for quite a long time.
Yes, good points there, and I agree with a lot of the things you're saying there. And of course, we have some different attempts at the structuring of these vehicles. We've seen with how Sprott has changed their vehicle a little bit and how that's been evolved. The expectation that this was going to grow at the rate that it grew in 2021 is just crazy, or even in 2022 for that matter. And then some of these other vehicles that we're seeing pop up, reference to Zuri Invest and how they've tried to answer their own form of the discount question. Not forgetting that when you reach critical mass in the case of Sprott, that you have, a nice reasonable fee that comes in off the management of that vehicle, plus all the other costs. I mean, let's just put it this way. It's not cheap to store these barrels at locations
No.
around the world. It's not cheap. It's costly, and there's a lot to it. And you're right. The average retail investor can't go out and buy, 100,000-pound lot and store it at ConverDyn or wherever it's going to be.
And you know what, it's a really astute point, actually, because we studied this with UPC. There is a neutral valuation that is at a discount for these kind of vehicles because they have operating costs. And so there is a model where you can present value sort of the future expected operating costs of storage or management. And if you were to like treat this kind of vehicle on a NAV basis, you would grind the value of the uranium down by the present value of those future costs. And so like the neutral place is probably a lid, low to mid single digit discount would be sort of a market neutral representation, trading level for any of these physical vehicles. So I mean, if you're at a say 10% discount, you're not, the 10% to view it as a 10% discount is wrong. You should be viewing it as really about a 5%, weighing about a 5% discount, for example, because there is a discount that's neutral associated with just operating the vehicle.
Good point to bring out here, and I think that's important for the audience to understand some of these other dynamics that just aren't being discussed amongst maybe some of the community that needs to do a little more of a deep dive on all the nuts, bolts, and washers that go into this thinking and how this is structured. David, let's move on here because I want to get into Denison, which is the point of the podcast here. But why don't we just kick it off here? We have quite a different audience, an added audience since we last spoke. It's been a few years, but for that new audience, just give us a brief overview of Denison Mines, and then we'll dive into some of the details.
And thanks for the opportunity to do that. So our company has quite a long history, but we are now focused in the Athabasca Basin region. So we are geographically centric as a developer in northern Saskatchewan. And we are unique in that we have a bit of a portfolio of development and mining and exploration assets, whereas many of our peers are sort of single project developers and or pure exploration companies. So our portfolio is anchored by a 95% interest in Wheeler River. This is a development stage project with two high-grade deposits. Together, they're the largest. It makes it the largest undeveloped uranium project in the eastern portion of the Athabasca Basin. We differentiate east from west simply to highlight the infrastructure difference. In the east, we are surrounded by existing roads, power lines, and social infrastructures associated with the existing mining operations that are operated by Cameco and Orano. Wheeler River is advanced in the permitting approval process for our Phoenix deposit, which is being brought forward as the first in-situ recovery uranium mine in Saskatchewan. We're several years into the environmental assessment permitting process after several years of technical de-risking, but we are now approaching the end of that permitting and approvals process and expecting to be working towards a final investment decision in the coming year or so. And I'm sure we will dive more into that. The company also has, though, a strategic interest, 22.5% in the McClean Lake joint venture. And the McClean Lake joint venture has a combination of the McClean Lake Mill, which is a world-class uranium processing facility. It is processing over 10% of global uranium production at the mill without dilution of very high-grade ore that's coming from the Cigar Lake mine under a toll milling agreement. It has excess licensed capacity, which is particularly meaningful for Denison and our partner Orano. And the mines that were previously operated at McClean, well, they've been relooked at now in the last several years using a mining method that we've developed in the McClean Lake joint venture called Saber. And we are now planning for a mining restart using the Saber mining method starting in 2025. So that will bring Denison back into the ranks of uranium producer a little bit quicker than where we'll get to on Wheeler River. And then we sort of round out the portfolio with a mix of grassroots exploration properties that are well situated. We're almost 400,000 hectares of exploration ground in the portfolio right now, and development assets. And so we call out typically our Waterberry Lake project, which is a partnership with KHNP, Korean state-owned nuclear power company, where we have also done ISR evaluation work and successfully tested the mining method at the THT deposit. And we are partners in other development assets in the area like Midwest, where we're a partner with Orano. And we have an indirect interest in Cameco's Millennium project as well. So it really is a portfolio company approach. And I'll tell you, I mean, while we are laser focused on delivering on Phoenix and Wheeler River, as a business manager, I really appreciate having the portfolio because there are so many other ways that we can add incremental or additional value to the company and to the benefit of our shareholders by being able to turn to assets that can add to our story rather than just focusing on execution. We will absolutely execute at Wheeler, but we can drive sort of a competitively better return to our shareholders in our view by being able to unlock value at other assets that are being undervalued when people look at our company. And we are doing that by bringing our technical team forward and evaluating other projects like Waterbury Lake and Midwest. And I think we can surprise the market in some ways around the potential to be a multi-asset developer and then ultimately a multi-asset producer in the not too distant future.
David, thank you for that overview. I definitely want to dive into a few of these thoughts and how you guys are structuring this. Before we do that, talk to us about capital structure here as far as shares outstanding, the cash and cash equivalents on hand, and major shareholders, including yourself and management.
Yeah, so we're running around 890 million shares out. We have very few dilutives, so your fully diluted is running at 902 million shares. We, of course, do have a long history, and I know many people have said, "Oh my goodness, look at all the shares." You have to understand what we've done with the proceeds from our financings. And that's where we really direct people to our global reserves and resource base. Of course, it's well disclosed in our public record, but you've got over 100 million pounds, Denison share, in proven and probable reserves on the other side of that, and significant resources indicated and inferred and historic on top of that. So I really do believe we've done a good job in deploying the money we've raised, and that people need to not focus on the number of shares, but what we did with it. And the sort of denominator is the number of shares and our fraction of value. And it's the numerator is what are the assets worth? You got to look at both of those things. We have also done really well with our balance sheet on this. So right now we're sitting with roughly $430 million Canadian in working capital and investments on the balance sheet. And that includes, and this is all as of the end of December 2023, that includes 2.3 million pounds of physical uranium that we issued shares to buy in 2021. And we bought it at $29 per pound. So on our financial statements, we're valuing that at the end of the year at $91 US per pound, representing roughly 277 million Canadian in market value. So that balance sheet strength, in addition to the physical uranium, we have about 131 million in cash and equivalents. But that balance sheet strength is incredibly important for a developer. And when you look at the scale of this, our CapEx at Phoenix is around, for our share, is around $400 million Canadian. So I do think we, from a capital structure standpoint, we are really unique in that we have essentially the CapEx for our project already on the balance sheet before we're permitted. And so the equity dilution risk moving forward from here, like indisputably, is comparatively lower than essentially any other company in our sector and potentially any other, commodity developer in the market. I certainly would challenge someone to find a company that's better positioned financially. Shareholders, we continue to have excellent support from our largest shareholder, which is Korea Hydro Nuclear Power. They're not only our partners at Waterbury, but they are our largest shareholder and they have board representation. And so we report insider ownership is around 7% in the company. We do have a very substantial institutional investor base, and we have an excellent retail base as well. Particularly in the United States, we see a lot of trading volume on our DNN ticker. We have become one of the go-to names in that space. So overall, we're pretty pleased with where we're at on the capital side of things, with the balance sheet funded up, and really looking to get ourselves to final investment decision, and finish up the financing with a pretty modest amount of additional capital.
David, thank you for that overview and good points on how people should really look at cap structure and how people should look at shares outstanding. And it is a psychological thing. We know that Canadian companies, tend to gear towards this, what they call tighter cap structures versus, say, our Aussie friends. But the reality is value is value, and it's simply a math equation when it comes down to looking at market cap and various valuations for assets. And I sometimes just have to laugh about people over possessing, "Oh, this company's got 5 billion shares out." Well, Yeah, okay, well, let's take a look at that and see how it really works out when you look at the math. The other piece there on financing, just wanted to ask. I know that it maybe isn't in the agenda this year, but just with, we don't know how market conditions are going to go the rest of this year. And when that construction decision comes, of course, you've already noted that you guys are in a substantially good position compared to peers to finance off what would be the focus project, which would be Phoenix, perhaps, maybe not. What do you see on the financing front this year? If you can, I know this is subjective, but anything on the financing front you could say as far as your guys' interest to potentially do something on financing during 2024?
Our focus this year, with this, with the balance sheet strength we have, I mean, there's absolutely no need to do anything. We have outlined our plans for the year in our most recent MD&A. It does include some guidance that we intend to sell about 300,000 pounds of physical uranium. So that would take us from 2.3 million down to 2 million. That's really a way to keep the balance sheet or the cash position in an incredibly strong place as we head into 2025, which is when we are expecting to make a final investment decision on Phoenix and essentially start project execution on the backside of that. And so that's our plan for the year. During the year, we will be focused on identifying and comparison shopping the different sources of additional capital that we might need. And this is not a large amount that we're looking for. As we've touched on already, our project requires about 400 million in upfront CapEx. We have 430 million in working capital and investments. But of course, there is some expenditure to get to that initial CapEx, and there will be some working capital required as well. So folks can sort of draw the conclusions in terms of the magnitude that remains, but it's not particularly large. And we will be looking at the different ways to access that capital so that when we approach a final investment decision, we have our plan A, B, and C ready to execute. Because really, and I don't mean to preempt where we might go with the discussion, to make an investment decision, you need to be permitted, you need to be ready to build, so you need your engineering designs and drawings and plans, and you need to have the money, so you need to be financed. And so we are working towards having all those things organized in the first half of 2025 for FID around the middle of 2025.
Definitely at this point, given your guys' position, you could leverage your financial position here. And of course, there's always some of that pre-construction activities and expenditures, even without permits, that may be low enough risk to approach. And so I appreciate your thinking on how this goes forward here. And we'll talk a little bit more on permitting here in just a moment. But why don't we move to Phoenix here and get a brief overview and, if I can say this, pre-construction activities update on what you guys are up to at Phoenix in preparation for that final investment decision in 2025.
Phoenix has been an incredibly exciting story for the last several years. And maybe I'll just start by recapping where we've come from. In 2020, in 2018, we completed a pre-feasibility study, which was the first time we had identified the in-situ recovery mining method for Phoenix. And so since then, we've been on a 5-6 year journey of de-risking that mining method, as this would be the first in-situ recovery uranium mine in Saskatchewan. And we've been incredibly successful doing that systematically, one step at a time. We've not cut corners. We've collected the data, we've analyzed the data, and then we've developed the next step in the de-risking process time after time. And it really culminated in the completion of a historic, literally Canadian history in the making type thing in 2022, where we completed what we called the feasibility field test. And so this was a test that combined all of the work we'd done for metallurgy in the lab using specialized equipment as well as just column leach tests with all of the work we had done in the field over those several years for hydrogeological conditions with pumping and injecting and identifying mapping flows. We combined both of those scopes of work with what we called the feasibility field test, where we installed a commercial scale test pattern. And we operated part of that test pattern with a live lixiviant mining solution and recovered over 14,000 pounds of U308 in solution from a field operational test. Subsequent to that, we restored the conditions subsurface through a neutralization step. And then in 2023, we've completed a compliance phase in this test where we call it the recovered solution management phase, where we basically reduced the volume of stored material on site and started now into 2024, the decommissioning of this site. This was the first known successful recovery of uranium via ISR mining techniques in the history of the province. And so that has been our focus. And when we pulled all that information together with years of work, we were able to successfully complete a feasibility study for Phoenix in the middle of 2023. And at that time, we also declared the substantial completion of the de-risking process for the project. So that not only confirmed the robust economics of the project, confirmed costs had gone up due to inflation, but we still had an incredibly positive project. It also marked the beginning of a transition away from studies and de-risking, and a transition into engineering and design. We started with a front-end engineering design process, sometimes called FEED, which ran for most of 2023. This is final optimizations, identification of long lead items and scheduling. You know, these are the sort of final trade-offs that you want to do before you start the next phase, which is detailed design engineering. And so by the end of 2023, we're substantially complete FEED work. And then in the beginning of 2024, earlier this year, we announced a $16 million contract with Wood. It's a global independent engineering consulting firm that supported us on the feasibility study. They are leading most of the scopes for our detailed design efforts. And that will be the priority on the technical side for the next year and a half, which is to advance the engineering design from the feasibility study and FEED all the way through the detailed design process, so that we are in a position to have those ready for construction drawings, where we have bid out and identified contractors, vendors to be able to execute on the project. And so that is quite an exciting time for us. Maybe not that exciting for the market, in that, you know, there aren't new studies or anything like that to come out from Phoenix, but quite an active and exciting time for us, because we are preparing to execute on the project, and the clock ticks pretty quick. You know, and we'll be mid 2025 before you know it, and looking to make a construction decision and then to execute.
Very important steps here on how you guys are approaching this, and it's pretty clear you guys have done some significant work here on the backside to make sure that things are organized properly, which, as you know, organization in this sector has been terrible for most folks involved. So appreciate that piece. On the permitting front, as you know, I don't even want to begin to think about the number of red tape that you have to cut through and how many permits from an actual count standpoint you've had to deal with, but I'm sure it's many of them, and maybe you even have the number off the top of your head. You're probably tired of looking at them. But on the permitting front, you know, you've got the local, provincial, federal level permitting. Just give us an update on where we are as far as maybe permits obtained that were key so far as far as milestones go, and then what outstanding major permits are left to get. And with that, what you see is the real time frame to complete the permitting, where you guys can now shuffle that permitting table aside and say, finally, we're there. Just talk about that for a moment.
Yeah, no, we're getting a lot of questions on permitting, and that's totally rational. There are several ancillary permits, but I mean, the items that you're really seeking here is a license to construct and a license to operate from our Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission. You know, there's similar equivalent permits from the province, but we are regulated by both the provincial and federal governments because of our being part of the nuclear supply chain. And so as it really works out in practice, the federal approval is really your critical path to operations. So the main gating item in the federal and the provincial process is an environmental assessment. So you're not going to be permitted to operate or construct unless you have a suitable environmental assessment. And there are, of course, other criteria to be able to be an operator, and that's more of the licensing process. But a lot of the discussion and the biggest scope and longest scope is the environmental assessment. And so maybe just to give folks a sense of the scope of work in an environmental assessment, we initiated the environmental assessment process in 2019. With the submission of a project description. We carried out years of technical assessments. This is not baseline. We had baseline data from years before that. It was technical assessments of the potential impacts of the project against a variety of criteria. That allowed us to submit in October 2022 draft environmental impact statement. Now, that document was in the range of 7,000 to 8,000 pages. And I think that maybe goes to what you're talking about in terms of the level of red tape. It's really just the level of effort and diligence that's necessary. Now, that document has been under review by our regulators, and our guidance at the time, and continues to be our guidance, is that it would be a 2 to 3 year process for us to work through all of the back and forth iterations with government and interested parties and final approval processes to be able to have an approved environmental impact statement, which would then be a critical ingredient in the overall licensing for the project. The process is progressing consistent with our expectation. We have not been providing much in the way of granular updates on it, but we did provide some indication in our latest disclosures around the success we've had with the provincial review. And the province has indicated to us that we've met their requirements to be able to proceed with an approved EIS. And we have just opted to continue with a linked process, though, with the federal and provincial EIS. And so we have not opted to go request the provincial approval yet, because we're trying to progress the federal approval and the federal review process to catch up. And so we gave some indication that we've had good success in reducing the number of queries and points of clarification from the federal government. And we continue to carry out that sort of iterative process of review and engagement with the government. And our hope is that we are nearing completion of that and can announce that during 2024.
Appreciate that. And what a tedious process. I have certainly some experience on that front with all of these regulatory processes. And it's for anybody to get through it, it's definitely a significant milestone and something that to some degree should be celebrated if you can get to a successful answer on the permitting front. So I appreciate the update on that. Give the audience a flavor here as far as what you think the build time is once that construction decision is made. So let's just assume, that's made by mid-2025, the decision, financing's in place, permits in place. What do you think that build time is once you guys get to that point?
Yeah, like in the feasibility study, we're estimating 2 years. And I think we have a relatively high level of confidence on that, and I'll explain why. But it has to do with all the field testing we've done. So, I mean, we have executed now, trialed or operated pretty much every element that would be associated with this project. And so we've got quite a good level of confidence with the engineering design that we're finalizing over the next year, but also the timelines and costs that it takes to do these things. I would say that this is unusual for mining projects. Of course, mining companies go and they work with credible people who have very good experience often that can give reliable estimates. Until you have started to mine or developing ground associated with your project, there is a large degree of unknown until you start doing that. And we have already installed commercial scale wells for our preliminary testing in the ore body. We know how to do it. We know how long it takes. We know how much it costs. These are the things that we have done. What are the other sort of scopes of work associated with our ISR mining? Diamond drilling for the freeze wall? Well, we've got hundreds of diamond drill holes in this area from all of our exploration work. We have great confidence around our ability to execute on the freeze wall installation. And then because we're not building a conventional mining operation, milling operation, there's no shaft sinking risk or open pitting risk and for timeline and schedule. And we're building a processing plant instead of a mill. So I differentiate that because there is no milling in our case. We do not take a rock ore out of the ground and have to crush, grind, handle it, and then leach it on surface. So the facility we have to build is comparatively simple when looking at conventional mining. We're building essentially a precipitation plant with a drying unit and a packaging system. So the risk around schedule and even cost, when you sort of read through that, it's simply lower owing to the nature of our mining method and our project. We do believe we can execute on that kind of schedule, and that is probably faster than any other greenfield mine development project in our area.
Well, let's move on here and talk a few more things here, just get continued context on how you guys are approaching this. With construction, commissioning, and operations expertise, David, obviously this is an area in this business specifically, amongst the general natural resource sector, actually is a bit starved of this, but the uranium sector is extra starved because of the history of this sector. And really talking over the last, call it 10 to 15 years, things have been pretty interesting in the sector as far as people leaving rather than staying. But how is work going on this front? Because it's a challenge. This is a lot of work, and it really has to start pretty early. But and I know you guys have been doing this. We've seen some news announcements on this front. But really, that staffing up with the proper people as the company transitions into these serious stages towards production.
You're dead on with this. Human resources, they're almost maybe even more valuable than our uranium resources. We can't access the uranium resources without our human resources. We've seen this years in advance, and what we've done with the ISR mining is remarkable. And we made a choice early on to invest in the people of our company, and so we have internalized most roles, and that is a difficult decision for a mining development company, because it's quite a commitment to bring people on, grow an in-house team. You have to have conviction around your project to do that. It's very normal for companies to use contractors, consultants, these sorts of things. We saw the importance of building the knowledge base around our mining method internally, having control of how we will interact with our people, not control over the people, control over how we will interact with them, rather than relying on a third-party firm to treat the people that your project relies on well. We want to be able to do that ourselves. And so we have been building our internal team for several years. The best way to demonstrate the degree of commitment we've made to this is to talk about our investment in a 12,000 square foot office building downtown in Saskatoon. We purchased this building over 2 years ago. We have renovated this building. It is exclusively for our use, and we are filling it up with people. And the reason we wanted to do this is because we wanted to make sure that we created a wonderful place for people to work. And I know this may seem like a detail, but we have a beautiful view of the river that runs through town. We're in a good location, and people are pleased to come into our office. It is part of an overall employee sort of value proposition that we've been working to deliver, because it is competitive. And there, it is important that we have continuity and great qualified people working for us. It is incredibly difficult right now in Saskatchewan to compete, because there is an enormous investment from BHP around the Jansen Potash mine, which has been quite disruptive to the overall labor market. But I'm pleased to say that we have been successful in finding people that have an inner drive to join our team. And putting those people in great opportunities and great positions where they can thrive. So we've done very well on human resources, and the key people that we need for this project to move forward, we have. And we are already working towards the strategies for staffing up the mine. I will say we are fortunate in that our mining method is less labor intensive than others because of the nature of the ISR mining. And so when it comes to staffing up an operation in northern Saskatchewan, where it has also been challenging, for example, for the incumbents to restaff their restart projects, the lift on our end for recruiting, a new crew is much lighter than people might think. I mean, our operation will work with 100 to 200 employees, and so that is a less than half of what you would see at each of like the mines or the mills that are operating. And of course, you have a mine and a mill at Cigar McLean, each with more than double those kind of numbers. So the ours would be a mine and mill in one, and we'd be operating between 100 and 200 employees. So that does make the recruitment of new people easier. It also means that if one of the solutions is to have a more competitive pay package, the cost to us is of less significance, because we just have a lower labor intensity when it comes to our mining operation.
one of the things it seems that you guys have been able to do is started to fulfill these positions or at least secure them behind the scenes as you guys progress here, because obviously there's other developers in the basin that are competing for that competent people, and there's so few of competent people to go around. And then, of course, you have existing incumbents there, you know, Cameco, for example, or Orano, that also continue to require people, as we know that a lot of the people that were around for McArthur River and Cigar Lake construction are no longer around for one reason or another, old age, other opportunities. We've seen that. So it is quite tough. And for you guys to be able to plan ahead of your competition makes some sense to be able to do that. And I think you guys have. And then also just another point, which I'll stop short on just because we have a limited time here and we need to get on to other things. But the access that you guys have over others to an existing facility, mill facility, you know, I think there's going to be some substantial challenges with respect to getting access to existing capacity on the mill front, let alone actually get the authorizations to build a new one. So that's another one which will, you know, I'm sure you have comments and we can talk about that. Say what you will. Maybe we leave that for another podcast. But also on that, let me shift gears here. I'll take any comments, of course, but let me shift gears to just getting your comments at this point on how Denison is approaching the term contract book to backstop these development projects.
Yeah, and maybe just quickly on the milling infrastructure, I think it's, you know, McClean Lake as an example, co-owned by Denison and Orano. I mean, we both have a joint interest in using the mill to process our ores. I mean, of course, first priority to the McClean Lake joint venture and its mines, but neither of us has an interest in being a toll miller for others. It's not the business we're in. So I do find it somehow sometimes quite interesting when others will refer to access to that capacity. That excess capacity is there for our benefit. It's not there for a competitor's benefit. And so I think if people are relying on availability of McClean Lake and they're not Denison or Orano, they're probably going to be disappointed. Yeah, in terms of the term contracting market, it is something that has moved to more front of mind. And you know, it was logical that we would be patient. And of course, well before Cameco started using the term strategic patience, we were actually strategically patient around contracting. In part because we wanted to see the results of the feasibility study and have greater clarity to what our production profile will look like at Phoenix. We have that now. And as that detailed design process moves forward, of course, on the technical side, on the commercial side, we are advancing our thinking around contracting our future production. And look, it's quite an interesting market that we have right now. Yes, I agree. Most of the material historically goes through the term market. Whenever we say term market, everyone thinks fixed price. It does not mean fixed price. It just means long-term supply agreements, often that have fixed price elements, but not always. And so that is the deliberation is for any producer is what is the mix of the characteristics of those term contracts. To sell to the spot market is generally not a good strategy because the volume of buyer activity in the spot market can be scarce at times, as we see when we see these little corrections. But it doesn't mean that you're not selling in reference to the market. And of course, that creates an interplay between the two markets, which is sometimes ridiculous because you might have a long-term contract that is priced based on a market-related indicator that then refers to a spot market that has little volume in it. And so our industry is a little bit broken that way when compared to the way in which other bulk commodity markets function, where even if you have a supply contract, it will point to a spot market that has a credible level of liquidity that gives you a half reliable estimate of what a real price is. And so that's a complication for us, and it's what we're focused on right now is how do we build a contract book that reflects those realities. One of the things that is an attribute for us is that our cost profile on Phoenix is so low in that, you know, we could believably enter into contracts that don't have, say, you know, market-related contract with a floor or a ceiling is typical, but we could believably enter into contracts with a very low floor, maybe in exchange for a very high ceiling, or with no floor. And very few producers and developers can say that because they don't have costs at the bottom of the cost curve. But that does mean that we have many options, and many options means that the analysis is more complicated than if you had a strong constraint. And I'll just give you the example. If you had a $45 production cost and you were trying to seek credit to finance your mine, well, some of your contracting decisions are going to be made by the bank. And the bank is going to say, I would like to see X percentage of your production under a fixed price contract that assures me the payback period of X, Y, or Z on the debt that we're going to extend to you. And that's, a hard constraint. And I don't judge any of our competitors that might have to do that based on their asset. That is not the wrong, that's not that that's a wrong choice. It's just it's a constraint that they have. And we don't have those constraints. And so it does mean that we have to apply a bit more judgment to the way in which we will sell our uranium. And I think people have come to appreciate that we are an organization that thinks about what we're doing. And we try to build rationale and a strategy around it. But we are also not a market influencer in that, we can't be a player that will set market prices necessarily. And so we probably will have to apply a layered approach with multiple strategies to address multiple possible market outcomes. That will be the sort of systematic approach we are taking to assess the market. And that work is underway this year. And it's well coordinated again with our schedule in terms of an FID decision in the middle of next year.
Well said. That approach that you highlighted makes a lot of sense. Let me ask you this, David, and I know this one's a little bit loaded, but does a low floor have anything to do with your understanding of this market and also the understanding of your actual costs?
Well, I think it's two different parts. If you have the luxury to be able to offer a low floor, then that's one thing. And I think we do have that luxury because of our cost structure. The thing is, why would you offer a low floor? You would offer a low floor if you're getting a high ceiling in return, and you're using it as a means to access higher participation in a high price environment. And that's something that very few of the players in our industry could reasonably offer and still have a sustainable business in the sort of, outlier scenario of a low price market. And so I think it does speak to, that kind of strategy would speak to a company that has a top tier asset, but that wants to preserve as much participation in a high price market as possible by being willing to give up a lower floor. I mean, I think it's reasonable that a market would function in a way where there's a bit of a reciprocity between floors and ceilings. If you want a higher ceiling, then you need to be prepared to offer a lower floor.
And I think you guys are in a great position to do that. Not everybody can say that. There's a few other parameters, but we'll stop there short. But we've certainly seen over the years as well, and you've seen this, we've seen companies get into contracts that term contracts that have not been that favorable, other than just to say, in some cases, that we were able to get one. That obviously has not worked out too well as this market's progressed. And certainly we knew it wouldn't have worked out so well had you not known the fundamentals and done the due diligence on where this market goes. Obviously has a big impact on how you approach with confidence these negotiations and how you structure them. So good comments there. And
And you just touch on an important point I want to pull on just very briefly, which is, I have heard the comment of like this sort of credibility de-risking associated with entering into a contract sort of for the sake of entering into a contract. I think our investors need to know that we don't have any contracts in place, not because we couldn't get one in place. We have many utilities that have expressed serious interest in signing contracts, even with us being in project that isn't undergoing permitting. The decision to not have done that yet was deliberate, based on our view and some of the remarks I made at the very beginning of this call, around how the market would evolve. And so we've decided not to be contracting as a strategy, and now we are seeing the next leg of the market, and this is the kind of market we want to contract in. But we will not go and enter into a contract just to say we have a contract. That's ridiculous. We will enter into contracts that fit the mold of our commercial strategy. And when we do that, it will be because we see it as being in our best interest.
Well said. And of course, we know that there's some folks out there who have done that and they won't say it. We all know that, but we'll see what happens. Of course, this shows up in financial results at some point, maybe many years down the road, but it does show up. So I appreciate your comments there and right on with my thinking as well, David. On concerns with ISR supply chain, you know, as far as supplies, reagents, processing equipment, ordered lead times, which you guys have already looked at, as you mentioned before, in light of challenges that we're seeing with ISR restart projects that have already started to surface and will continue to surface in here in 2024 as we see people try their hand at these restarts. And then, of course, we know that, you know, fabrication facilities and just overall issues coming out of the events of the 2020-2021 period still impact us today and will continue to impact us, sadly to say, for years ahead because of the decisions, poor decisions that were made during that period of time by some of our leaders around this world. But nonetheless, besides that, that supply chain fragility, if you will, chemical procurement, for example, not really associated here, but Kazatomprom's known sulfuric acid shortage is not an issue, I don't think, for Denison here, obviously, on that specific topic. But just talk about how you look at the ISR supply chain and sensitivities there, and if you guys are seeing any challenges that are notable that you haven't already taken care of.
Yeah, it's a great question. And we have had some questions specifically around access to sulfuric acid because of the developments in Kazakhstan. So I think it's fair for me to just clarify on that point specifically that, you know, we are not procuring sulfur or sulfuric acid from the same places that Kazatomprom would be. We are in a wonderful part of the world in Saskatchewan, Canada, where we have an excellent access to sulfur that is the byproduct of the Canadian oil sands operations in Alberta. And so while there absolutely have been some disruptions in terms of the overall supply chain during that period where we saw such supply chain mess, we do not perceive or expect to see any of these types of issues that we've seen out of Kazakhstan for our access to sulfur because or sulfuric acid because sulfur is abundant and proximal to us in our neighboring province of Alberta. But broadly, I mean, we are also the beneficiaries in other ways of that same infrastructure in Alberta when it comes to materials and people who are able to execute unskilled on projects and skilled activities. Because our project, it's really interesting, Andrew, actually, like our project will be quite meaningful in the uranium market, you know, producing on average 8 to 9 million pounds in its first per year in its first 5 years. That'll make it a meaningful, you know, certainly top 10 a uranium mine in the world. And so people think it must be big. It's not big. You know, we have very high grades. And so the footprint of what we're building is small. The processing plant is small. The area of our well field is small. The amount of materials we need is comparatively small. The materials that we need, we've already demonstrated at the worst of the supply chain sort of nightmare that we went through as a global economy, we've already demonstrated we could get the materials. So you have to remember, we built our feasibility field test facility in 2022, like at the worst of times. And we were able to procure the materials for a first of its kind historic ISR field test. Well, how did we do that? We are mostly buying things that already exist, that are already being deployed in industrial settings, piping, pumps, you know, like casings. These are things that are already being used. That's how we could do that. We didn't need to invent something. We didn't need to go get something specialized commissioned. A wellhead is a wellhead for us, the way we're doing this ISR mining. And wellheads exist in the oil and gas industry and are accessible. So we were able to succeed with the supply chain at the worst of times during a novel, first of its kind historic field test. Our team is diligently planning and identifying critical items on the supply chain now, and we've already started to execute procurement so that we can be organized to start construction on the back of an FID decision. And I'll give an example, and we've started to disclose this. But we already started procuring several key scopes in late 2023 because the lead times are long. We have a long schedule of the materials we need from our feed process, and we've already identified how long it takes to get everything, where it will generally come from, and which ones we need to action on now. And we've also announced in our results and our guidance for 2024 that we'll spend another $10 million this year on long lead procurement, progress payments, and other purchase commitments to be in a position where items that we need to order now are on order now, so that we can be in position to execute in mid-2025. So overall, we are benefiting from a good sort of overall ecosystem in our part of the world, and from our preparedness, from our team, making sure that we don't miss any of these key items, and we can be early if the supply chain requires us to be early.
David, I appreciate the comments there. I think we're in pretty good hands on your guys' ability to be able to plan and all the really the years of planning that have already passed us on how you guys have approached this. And of course, know that there's some very good staff there, including yourself, that have been able to look at this and be able to network properly and get these things done in a good progressive fashion to where there's very little delays, which is very good to see as well. With that, just tying up on projects here overall for the company. What is your take on how you see the sequencing here going forward of the project portfolio and the timing of those on the schedule, whether they, well, essentially they will be going concurrently together, but obviously there's a stacking of production profiles that you'll evaluate and look at that on a financial basis and economic basis and all the other permitting times and all these other things that play into how you factor in those various layers. But you have essentially a starter project and really a test case at Waterbury. And also you have an underground conventional at Griffin that is fairly straightforward. And then, of course, you've got Phoenix. How do you see that these lay out in your mind? Because I think right now the market is thinking that Phoenix is the first to go. But how do you see that layout happen?
Well, yeah, I mean, Phoenix is definitely the front of the line. It is where our focus is at. So, Phoenix is on track for that first production in sort of late 2027, 2028 timeline. And Phoenix is incredibly robust economically, and so it generates quite a lot of free cash flow very rapidly. And that's why we're focused there. We really want to reduce the burden on our shareholders in the pre-production period. There's only so many ways to raise money during that period, and they all have some form of dilution. So we'd like to stay focused primarily on Phoenix and get to those free cash flows. The Griffin Underground Mine, also at Wheeler River, is an excellent way to reinvest those cash flows. It does have a significant capital cost because it's an underground mine, but just based on the cash flow that we'll generate from Phoenix, it can be funded internally without any major concern there. And so that is the best way for a project that has that higher CapEx to be funded is via internal cash flows rather than any sort of equity dilution. And so we've naturally deferred any significant investment or decision on Griffin until we have progressed Phoenix further, because we would like to be able to redeploy the cash flow that comes from Phoenix as an economic way to fund Griffin. In terms of the other assets, there is the potential for a Tejal Death Tway or THT deposit at Waterbury Lake to be advanced independently of that sort of Phoenix Griffin stacking, because the CapEx is potentially very low, and we have a very strong partner there with KHNP. So we are evaluating Waterbury Lake. We carried out an important field test at THT for ISR late last year, which was highly successful. And that's given us critical information to be able to advance the technical analysis. So we've also identified the potential in our outlook for 2024 and our potential to complete a pre-feasibility study for that project. So that's under evaluation. And that project is small scale. And so the CapEx required for it is also comparatively smaller scale. And so it can happen, in my view, independently or in parallel with some of our progression at Phoenix. The other one that, maybe just touch on two others, because again, we've got this portfolio of assets. One that I think is maybe underappreciated is the work that we're doing together with Orano at the Midwest project. So we own 25, just over 25% of Midwest. Midwest is a project that we've been evaluating for Orano and for the joint venture over the last few years for potential use of ISR mining. It's also a target potentially for the Saber mining method that we're using at McClean Lake. And so we have completed an internal concept study And we are now carrying out some additional field tests at Midwest that we believe could support the completion in the future of a potential PEA for the project. And so Midwest is also in the pipeline. And because we have a minority interest there, really the pace at which that would move would be driven by Orano. But we do know that Orano has a great interest in securing new sources of supply into the 2030s. And so we are quite optimistic where that will go. And then the last item is McClean Lake itself and the mining restart decision that we've announced there. So we will be mining as preparations in 2024 and mining in 2025 at the McClean North deposit using our Saber mining method. Really no CapEx to get this running. We already own all the equipment. We already have the surface infrastructure in place. The project is already permitted. And so, really, just a program in 2024 to drill pilot holes and prepare the mine for operation in 2025. And the vision is that that would be the first of a 5 or 6 year mining program at McClean North and the Cariboo deposits, which could produce in the range of 3.8 million pounds for the joint venture. So, not as sequential as it might seem, actually, Andrew, but Phoenix and Griffin certainly in order. But the other assets give us this enormous optionality that isn't reliant on the timing of the other projects.
That's good there. I liked a little bit of starter at McClean Lake and the work going on there. I think that all just brings us in really well. And then also, if it's sequenced well off and things go as we expect, maybe there's no need for equity dilution on the subsequent projects. Obviously, those kind of cash flows, you could do a lot with exploration work. You could do a lot with bringing on some of these satellite deposits on the conventional side. There's just a lot of stuff you could do here as things start to ramp up, especially when the cash flow comes in. So, looks pretty good. I appreciate your comments on how you see the sequencing, and I think you guys have thought about this quite a bit. Well, I'll skip on Sabre. You mentioned that, so I think we're good there. On community efforts, talk about maybe some of the important initiatives that Denison is doing to utilize local service providers, create jobs. Obviously, we see more jobs coming. Educate and develop skills in the community on the importance of responsible mining and energy development. That's, I think, another one that people sometimes tend to miss. That's very important now as we deal with communities that generally don't have a good education of the importance of mining and proper use of energy and good energy sources that actually work well, as well as anything else you'd like to mention on this front that Denison is doing.
Our focus on community engagement has been top of mind for the last several years. I would say we are maybe in an enviable spot with our location in that we are working in the Eastern Athabasca Basin. And so the call the indigenous and northern communities that have an interest in our project, they actually have quite a good familiarity with uranium mining operations. And the economic benefit associated with them and the rigorous levels of regulatory oversight and safety controls. And so, while education broadly is a real priority in all of these communities, and it's a priority of the communities, not necessarily of us, we are happy to support all of that. But I find that it's actually not the area that requires attention. These are mature indigenous communities, and there's been quite a transition in Canada around the concept of reconciliation and economic reconciliation and the role of industry. And we have tried to be a leader in that. We are pretty much the only company that we're aware of that has a board-approved Indigenous Peoples Policy, which is available on our website and publicly outlines the company's perspectives on the commitments and the role that we have in advancing reconciliation in Canada. But what we've tried to do, Andrew, is we've tried to reflect the community's desires in what we're doing. And so we've reached a number of exploration agreements that underpin all of our projects pre-construction in the region with multiple groups. And that's been a product of open negotiation, reflecting the things that matter to those communities. And absolutely, business development is an area of focus, but so is engagement and the way in which we permit and our projects, the way in which we communicate the types of work that we're doing and the protocols we're following. Those are equally important parts of those agreements. And it's often not realized that, there's just an honest interest in protecting the land and having a role in oversight from these groups, oversight in the work that we're doing, they have an interest in that. And so we have listened to their interests, and we've tried to reflect those in the agreements that we've reached. Now, we have progressed on more substantive agreements related to Wheeler River, and in September of 2023, we announced what we consider to be a landmark or milestone agreement with English River First Nation. It's called a Shared Prosperity Agreement. It is like an impact benefit type agreement, but it reflects our commitment to English River First Nation, which is a group that has a very close connection to the ground in which the Wheeler River Project is located. And the outcome of that agreement that's really notable for us is that we've obtained consent from the nation to progress with our project. And that is the sort of target of our aspirations with Indigenous engagement is to have consent to work in ancestral or traditional lands. So we're very proud about that. And that agreement was potentially itself history making in Saskatchewan, in that a requirement of English River First Nation is that they would hold a community ratification type vote on our on the agreement that had been negotiated. We were successful, and the nation was successful in gaining significant community support via a democratic process for our shared prosperity agreement. And it just speaks to how forward thinking we're willing to be when it comes to engaging with Indigenous groups in the ways in which they want to be engaged. There's more work to do. We are working with additional groups to reach similar agreements, but those are all meant to stack on top of existing agreements that we have on the exploration front.
That's great. Really appreciate that. And getting into this phase now where these communities can start to see the results of these efforts and actually start to see that come to reality rather than obviously all of these years of hope and expectation and all these things. We're finally now getting there. So I think that's great and really appreciate your guys' efforts to continue to educate these communities on the importance of what you guys are doing here and the responsible nature of this efforts and how it's so important to not only the local community, but the provincial level, federal level, and even global level as well. So appreciate the
There was no better way for us to do that, and I'm sorry to cut in, but then the work we did in the feasibility field test. Our primary construction contractor, Tron, was owned by English River First Nation, and our primary civil contractor, PBN, owned by connected to Pinehouse and Kanipik Métis Local Number 9, out of Pinehouse, and our workforce during the field test significant. I don't have the exact numbers here, but certainly over half of our workforce at some of the peak times is from folks from nearby communities. And in a way, that experience with our field test was valuable beyond just demonstrating the business development opportunities, but from an education standpoint. We had people from the north, from the communities that are connected to this land, working on our test project to be able to go back to their communities, speak to their family and friends about how they were part of making history in Canadian mining, but also how responsibly a company we were and how responsibly we operated that test.
Well, David, why don't we're starting to wrap up here, but I just want to discuss briefly overall strategy for this company long term and what your preference is as far as becoming a cash flowing business with operations, which is clearly has been the demonstrated focus. Maybe going down the road here, as you look at this market, as you look at the progress of this company, it's going to be significantly different in 5 years, 7 years, and 10 years out. What do you see as the end longer term strategy with the conditions in this market for Denison to be purchased by others as the business progresses at some stage? How do you look at that longer term view of this company?
You're right. I mean, it sounds like our message is getting across perfectly fine, that we intend to be, a sustainable operator of these projects and get them into cash flowing, state, and generate a good return to our shareholders by operating. That is our plan. I think we all know that successful operation of profitable mining operations inherently make you a target for potentially larger operators. But that is not the design of our strategy. I mean, that is a natural byproduct of a strategy of execution. But we're also not afraid of growth. And, we have continued to invest in exploration over the last several years, and we will continue to do that. a unique part of our story. And look, I mean, it's easiest to contrast to NextGen. NextGen is an excellent company with an excellent asset. One of their biggest challenges is they already have an excellent asset that produces for many, many years once it's in operation. What more can they do in terms of adding value than already having an excellent large-scale asset? We have excellent assets, but we could use more pounds, and we will generate cash flow that could fund expansion. And so it would be wonderful for us to make a satellite discovery that could feed the Phoenix plant. And so exploration for us really can move the needle by affecting our valuation in a nearer term horizon than a company, or a company with an asset like NextGen's. And so we will focus on that, because adding to our production pipeline with assets that can make use of existing infrastructure, whether it be at McClean or the Phoenix plant that we'll be building, they can significantly change the future value of the company. And so that is our secondary focus right now, is on making sure that we are not waiting too long to be investing in growth. We're continuing to do it now, because it takes time to find new deposits. And we will be active evaluating all of the discoveries and any of the companies that are operating in our region. We will follow all of their results, but we will look for assets that can add to our value and fill in that production profile over the longer run as a means to build a truly sustainable uranium mining business.
It's great to be in that position. Well, David, thanks for your time. Let's leave it there for now. And for potential investors who are listening in, the company has a market capitalization of about $1.6 billion. Why should Denison Mines be considered within the institutional family office and retail investors portfolio at this stage?
Yeah, I'll call out a few key items that differentiate us. First, we're a multi-asset developer, and our assets are priced into the bottom quartile of the cost curve. That is unique. And to have multiple development assets in the bottom quartile of the cost curve, advanced at the state that they are now after years of work during difficult markets, you can't go back and buy time. So significant investments and the things that needed to happen to position us to exploit improving market fundamentals, it's already happened. I think that's an important differentiator. And it's happened in a company that has a portfolio of things. So it's not just one project that moves forward. One project catalyzes the next. And our balance sheet, we touched on it earlier, but I really do challenge people to find a company that's better financed at this stage of a development sort of project life cycle. $430 million in working capital and investments on the balance sheet at the end of 2023, and initial CapEx, our share, around $400 million. So that risk of future equity dilution is just comparatively lower. We have a flagship project that has potentially the lowest costs in the industry. It's been substantially de-risked, and we are well advanced in permitting. So the catalysts that remain are significant, but they are unlocking higher re-ratings to NAV as we approach development decision and then ultimately production. And I think that is quite a unique profile right now, and it's hard work in the past that's put us to where we are now.
Looks like the audience has a little bit of homework to do. And David, best way for folks to reach out to the company?
We would encourage people to visit our website at denisonmines.com. Also, follow us on our social media. We do have pretty good traction on social media, and so if you're following us on X, that would be at Denison Mines Co.
Well, David, thanks. Great to have you back to update on work at Denison. Keep up the efforts, and looking forward to having you back later this year. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much.